Everyone, this is Dr. Campbell. I'm going to call the meeting of the Arizona State Board of Podiatry Examiners. Call to order at 8:33 a.m. on April the 8th, 2020. I'm going to do a voice roll call of board members only since we are telephonic. Dr. Yolano?
Present here.
Dr. Foreman?
Present.
Mr. Rhodes?
Present.
Dr. Campbell? Present. And also we have Heather Brodus, our executive director, and Seamus Monahan, our assistant attorney general. Does anyone have any declaration of any conflicts of interest to declare? We're going to proceed then to letter A under item 5. This is for an update on the investigator's review for an audit for Dr. Patrick Farrell. This complaint number is 1826-C, and Dr. Cohn is the investigator, and I will ask Dr. Cohn to please give his report, and we should also note that Dr. Farrell is present here in the boardroom. Thank you. Dr. Cohn?
Hi, and thank you. Again, this is Dr. Cohn. This involves case 1826C, and it's basically, today is a follow-up of a report that's been ongoing, and I think it needs to make the board, I'm requesting the board make some decisions in this case. This case, 1826C, was initiated back in November. My investigation was initiated in November of 2018. At that time, the board that was present heard the investigative report. One of the issues that had been identified in our investigative report involved poor record keeping and documentation. As far as the record keeping and documentation went, the board felt that that appeared to be an issue, but to be sure, they had asked that it be reviewed further by an audit. So they had requested, so an audit was requested, and this was done with Ms. Kimberly Kent's office, who had originally represented Dr. Farrell. The audit itself began to get work done on June 11, 2019. That report has been submitted to you as well. Within that report itself, the conclusions were that there was still a significant issue with Dr. Farrell and his documentation. This report wasn't meant to be looking at care that was provided in the sense of did the patient have good results or bad results. So there are some patients in the report on this audit that had good results or positive results from the study. The unfortunate thing is that whether the of the cases I had reviewed, almost everyone had demonstrated poor record keeping and documentation, which could have led to trouble or a poor outcome for the patient that was identified. And that report was submitted to you back, well, worked on starting in June of 2019. That you have as well. The time of that report and presentation to the board, Dr. Farrell had made statements, and I'm not quoting, but that his documentation was getting better and that he was getting a new record-keeping system because of many of his problems were associated with his prior record-keeping system, and he would be able to do better. So the board had then said we should do another audit, and that audit was audited to be on new records from new patients when Dr. Farrell placed his new record system in the office, which was supposed to have been done shortly after this prior report that was worked on in 2019. Unfortunately, I did not get a report, and in January 15 of 2020, I submitted a list of questions for Dr. Farrell to Kimberly Kent and received answers. I believe you have that short questionnaire on hand, too. Essentially, it involved whether an EHR had yet been installed, what the name was he utilizing it, and the outcome of that study is that he did not have an EHR, and he was not using a new HR. There were essentially no changes. Based on that, I felt that this needed to come back to you, the board, to make a decision of some sort. Because, as noted, originally we're starting with the case that was initiated, and I'm just looking back my notes, in 2018. It was audited once in 2019, and we are now in today's date of April of 20, and I have not been able to get a report from Dr. Carroll. Apparently, the prior attorney representing is no longer involved. I don't know the situation, but my suggestion to the board at this time is essentially a board decision should be made. The problem was documentation. The initial audit was poor. The initial case we reviewed, the documentation was poor. He's not provided us with any records within his questionnaire that I provided. Essentially, he hadn't even gotten a new documentation system, medical record system in the office. So nothing had been in, nothing has been set up, and nothing has been done that the board has requested to improve his care of patients. So that's a short review of some of the stuff that's gone on for almost 2 years, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn. This is Dr. Campbell. Do any of the board members have questions for Dr. Cohn? Gentlemen? Dr.
No.
Ilano or Dr. Foreman or Mr. Rhodes?
No. No.
No questions.
Thank you. All right. So, Dr. Farrell is here, as I mentioned, so we'll ask Dr. Farrell to give us an update on what's going on, and then we'll have the opportunity to direct questions at Dr. Farrell. So, Dr. Farrell, please.
Hi, I'm Patrick Farrell, DPM. I've been working on several projects trying to get my documentation improved. I first went and got a Dragon Up Dictate, and my IT guy said my computer system is not big enough for this Dragon Dictate. So now I'm working with the Dragon Dictate company trying to get a cloud-based Dragon Dictate. And I'm also working with the hospital getting Dragon and seeing if the hospital let me. I use the hospital's Epic system probably 70% of the time because that's where I do my surgeries. And those documentations are in the hospital's record. And so I'm trying to get them to sell me into their Epic program. I use their Epic program and starting to use their Dragon Dictate on that Epic program. The current program I have was with a company out of Phoenix here, Jameson was the name of the guy who ran the company, and I use that in my office, and I use that for documentation. I'm trying to improve myself on that. I do my operative reports with that, and I do my current office notes on that. I try to be more inclusive in my office notes. And if you want, I've sent in other operative reports on all my nerve surgeries. This is another complaint to me because I didn't do EMG nerve conduction studies. And if you there was probably 10 charts that I sent in on nerve surgeries that I did, and they all have nerve conduction studies, and you can see the progress I've made on my documentation with that. Any questions?
So when you got with your new system, you mentioned that they gave you a video and a workbook. Did they not give you any other training, or they just kind of left you to your own devices here?
Yeah, that's it. HTH Engineering is the name of the company where I got the Dragon Dictate out of. I'm getting back on the line with them to see if I can get the cloud-based Dragon Dictate to just do the dictations, that I don't have to have this upbringing of my computer system in the office, which would end up costing me quite a bit of money that I don't have.
I have a question. This is Dr. Foreman regarding the Epic system. So you're going to be using that 70% of the time, and then your home, your office, Jameson, is what? Do you know the name of the actual EHR you're using in your office?
I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I could give that back to the board, or I can make a call to my office for them to give me the name of it, but I don't have the...
Because I'm confused. If you're doing 70% of your work on Epic, which you said you're doing your operative reports on, then you said you're doing 30% in your office, which you're doing your operative reports on. So Epic for your operative report?
If I do
or,
it... If
or
I,
your...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I use Epic for the hospital's operations, and I use my office. If I do a office surgery, say a toenail procedure or something, I use my own computer system, and I do an operative report through the computer on that. I do the post-op office visits on my computer in the office. I try to get more inclusive of what you guys want and what's needed. Like I said, Epic is getting to be more and more of my use, and so I've contacted the hospital, and they're supposed to get back to me what that's going to cost me to incorporate into my office.
When was the last time you contacted them, Dr. Farrell, the hospital, about that program?
That would be last Friday.
This is Dr. Ilano. On your EHR system, how many hours do you say per week or per day do you try to figure it out or get familiarize yourself with this?
With my current EHR?
Yes, your new one.
I've had the current. Well, I couldn't get the new one with the Dragon Dictate onto my system because the program for Dragon Dictate was too large according to my IT guy. So I've been using my old EHR through Jameson for my documentation for post-operative care.
Do you use any paper charts at all at this point?
Yes.
What are you paper charting? What type of are you just...
Well, when people ask for a copy of their chart, they get it in paper.
Right, but I mean
you're... I keep the chart on what I give out.
So you're actually writing, you write your notes on a paper chart. Do you scan that then into your computer, or you keep a, you're keeping
yes, I
a paper?
Yes, I have a person in my office that transfers that into the computer.
This is Dr. Alon, have we got copies of those paper charts that you write on?
Not with me, no.
Have you submitted them?
I missed your question, Dr. Alano.
Yeah, have you submitted any paper written charts so the board can take a look at it or review
well,
it?
Well, once the paper is transferred into the computer, it's thrown out. I have charts that I keep. If I give out, I don't give people a computer disk with their chart. I just give them a printed out copy of their chart. Same thing the hospital would do with a visit to the hospital.
Can I make a comment?
Please.
To clarify that for you? Dr. Cohn talking. In all the charts I've reviewed, I've never seen anything that was written by hand. I think what Dr. Ilano is saying, Dr. Farrell is saying is, if you request a copy of the chart, he has it printed off and he gives you the computer-generated chart. Because within all the records I have sitting here, there's never been a document, there's never been anything that was written by Dr. Farrell that was included as a part of the notes. I think he's just including, I think he's referring to his chart, which is where the poor documentation was. The other thing, if I can, is in all the charts I've reviewed, you know, if doctor does the surgery, there'd be an op report that would come from the hospital. But all the preoperative care, all the postoperative care, so I would tell you 99% of his record keeping and documentation is done in the office and is done on his office documentation. It's not done on the hospital's Epic system. I just wanted to clarify the notes, that there is no written notes in his charting.
Did we request for those notes that written or in the AHR?
Yes, we do. When we request records for an audit, we request copies of everything, x-rays, records, billing, everything is to be provided.
Okay, and Dr. Farrell didn't submit those?
He submitted his...
Gentlemen, one at a time.
He submitted his records. But within the records, there was nothing ever handwritten. It was purely a computer-generated report. That's all. Which is typical of most physician offices anymore. Problem is that his documentation for that patient care was not what it should be. And the percentages are much higher in the office than Dr. Farrell's saying. I'm not sure that he can have 70% records of all he's putting in the Epic system as the hospital's operative report.
Well, I spend a lot of time like at the hospital. I'm on ER call this week. I'm having someone cover me while I'm in Phoenix, but I'm on ER call for 7 days out of the 28. After the ER call, a lot of times it'll take 1 to 2 weeks to completely get my patients out of the hospital sometimes. These are diabetics, mostly with gangrene and amputations.
So where are you, Dr. Farrell, with the IT people and getting the...
Well, I talked with my IT guy last Wednesday, and he's trying to work together with me with this cloud-based... he said he'd help me with that. He thought that would be a better idea than upgrading my computer systems into... getting all new setups and stuff.
This is Dr. Foreman. So when does your computer guy think it's going to be, your cloud-based system is going to be live?
I don't know. The last time I asked him to do something, it took him like 4 months to get back to me that he can't do something. I'm pushing on him now, and I think it might be going live in about 2 months.
Dr. Farrell, is he the only person you could be working with at that company? I mean, is there any way that they could, you know, to expedite things a little bit?
He's not with HTH Engineering. I have somebody else at HTH that I talk with. I'm getting on the line with them. That's where I found out about this cloud-based.
So you could potentially get this done a little sooner.
Yeah.
Dealing with
like
somebody else.
2 to 3 weeks.
Well, that's what, you know, I think, you know, approaching, you know, getting on the horn with them, and because this is, you know, as we've all discussed, this has been a long, involved and drawn out situation. And of course, obviously, with the current health situation we're in, that, you know, it is, you know, more difficult if there's, you know, that working with you, if they're not able to come to your office, that they can, you know, work with you virtually. But I would strongly, that would be my opinion, that I would strongly suggest speaking with someone else in that. Because if you've had problems with somebody, not, you know, 4 months to get somebody to respond to you, that's getting a little long. So
That's another reason I talked with the hospital to see if I could get Epic incorporated into my office. Since I'm familiar with Epic, I use it a lot in the hospital. It would be just wise to get that in my office. And I talked with them last Friday. I've got irons in two different fires trying to get this thing to fruition. And hopefully within the next 3 to 4 weeks, I can get this done.
Gentlemen, anybody else have any other questions or comments they'd like to make?
I would try calling Dragon up and seeing if you can work with them. If it's a cloud-based system, you may not need anybody physically in your office.
And that's one of the fires that I got my irons in.
So it sounds like we have, Dr. Farrell has these possibilities. He's still going with the EPIC program through his hospital, working with the Dragon Cloud option, and the fact that he's continuing with his current program in the office. So we need to decide here how we're going to handle this situation from here on out. You know, we have that possible violation of a state statute, which is 32-854.01, which is the heading of unprofessional conduct, and number 22 is violation of a formal order, probation, or stipulation showing issued by the board pursuant to the chapter. So there's been a lot of, you know, back and forth and back and forth here. So I hope everybody understands, you know, the gravity of this. This is time consuming for everybody. So, you know, we need to, you know, come up with an option here for this.
Well, it's not that I'm not documenting. I am documenting. I just would like a better system at this documentation. I'm currently using my current program still. And like Dr. Cohn said, nothing I've sent him was handwritten. It's all written out and hand documented. Not the hand documented. It's documented of what I've done.
Well, I mean, maybe an option that we have here is, you know, for Dr. Farrell to that chart audit happens on what system that he's currently using, and maybe you know, give, you know, I hate extending, but you know, 30 days to get some kind of resolution with it's you know, are we going to have the Epic program being used or the Dragon Cloud here? What do you
think? I think the 30 days would be adequate.
Pardon me, Dr. Foreman?
This is Dr. Foreman. I think 30 days is, we should just do one more month, and that's enough time to get something up. I don't think waiting for his the company he's using right now is realistic, but 30 days is enough time to get something going on his EHR.
Dr. Yolano or Mr. Rhodes?
Yeah, I'd recommend giving him 30 days, and at that time, give a report, and if that doesn't happen, then take further action.
Yeah, to me, 30 days is fine. It's been going on for 2 years, but I've got to see some movement, a lot of movement within these 30 days.
So would you be amenable also to maybe each week that Dr. Farrell report to Heather at the board office as to what is going on?
Sure.
Yes.
I'd like to be keep informed and see how the progress is going. But again, it's been over 2 years that this has been going on, and the board has been very nice to Dr. Farrell and lenient.
Dr. Farrell, how many patients are you seeing now in the office with everything that's occurring?
With this virus, it's knocked us down to probably 12 a day.
So you do have the time to address these problems?
I do.
Okay. Mr. Monahan, do you have any comments? Do I need to make a motion? Okay. So I will make a motion to Dr. Farrell 30 days to have a system in a working system in regards to his office charting, so that we can evaluate, make sure that he's got a good working program, and then see in a month's time where we are, and also ask in that Dr. Farrell present a update to Heather Broaddus, our executive director, weekly, and that then we will revisit this issue at the next board meeting. Do I have a second?
Seconded.
Is there any other discussion on this case? Then I'll take a voice vote since we are telephonic. Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Yolano?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Thank you. So moved. All right, thank you, Dr. Farrell, and you'll be keeping up here with Heather. Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been my privilege. Thanks.
All right, now we are moving on to 5A, which we had have an informal hearing scheduled on complaint 19-30-B, Dr. Eugene D. Dela Cruz.
Excuse me.
Is Dr. Dela Cruz present on the phone? I know Mr. Whittakin, his attorney, is present. Is Dr. Farrell present? Pardon me, I'm sorry. Dr. Dela Cruz present?
No, Dr. Dela Cruz is not present.
Okay, thank you. I was trying just to double check myself. We have been approached by Mr. Whittakin to, he has asked us for an extension.
Agenda item 6.
Oh, I'm sorry, agenda item 6.
Seven.
I'm sorry. So we'll go, we'll strike that from, I mean, from, we're not on 5A, we will be on 7. Board to, we're going to review, discuss, and take possible action regarding the administrative order of 2020. No, pardon me, that's incorrect. 7, board to review, discuss, and take possible action regarding a respondent's request to a continuation of an informal hearing for the complaint number 19-30-B, Dr. Eugene Delacruz. Thank you. Pardon me for my flub up there. So, we have received this. Heather, do you want or Seamus to give an update on our summary?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In February, it was late February, whenever I noticed Dr. Delacruz and his attorney, Mr. Whittakin, that this issue would be going to an informal hearing because Dr. Delacruz did not accept the offered consent agreement and order, and that was presented to him in mid-January. And at the attorney's request and Dr. Delacruz's request, this was moved to an informal hearing. So on Monday, this past Monday, April 6th, I got an email from Mr. Whittakin requesting a continuance due to the fact that majority of the board members were going to be telephonic, and Mr. Whittakin and Dr. Delacruz would prefer to appear before the board in person when the majority of the board members can also be in person at the meeting. So because of the short time frame in which this request was made, it's up to the board to determine whether or not they would accept the continuance request. And I'm available for any questions, but that's a brief summary.
Dr. Ilano, Dr. Foreman, or Mr. Rhodes, what are your comments and thoughts?
Excuse me, board Chair, members of the board. I think that it would be appropriate at this time to allow the attorney for Dr. Delacruz to orally make his formal request as well, if there's anything he'd like to say.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, that's appropriate. Sorry. Yes, Mr. Whittakin, I would then ask you for your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the board. I did submit a formal written request with my explanation. I don't know if all of the members of the board have had an opportunity to see that. But in brief, the consent decree that was proposed is a decree of censure, which is obviously one of the most significant actions the board can take. We did accept the invitation for the in-person informal hearing. Typically, in a case like this, Dr. Delacruz or whoever I was representing would spend considerable time in person preparing our presentations for the board. This case involves care that was provided by multiple providers, including Dr. Delacruz, over a period of several months, three surgeries, extensive records, and we would typically go through all of those to address what we anticipate the questions might be. I've been at home, as I suspect many of you have, for similar reasons, for the past several weeks. I have not been able to meet with Dr. Delacruz and prepare the way we would typically do. There is, as I noted in my formal written request, this is not an emergent issue. There is no allegation that there's Dr. Delacruz, who some of you may or may not know, but is highly experienced, is simply put, we haven't been able to prepare for this. We would like the opportunity to get this in front of the board and address the questions in person because it is a relatively complex case. And so what we've asked is that we be allowed to do our in-person presentation at the board's hopefully early convenience. And that's the pending request.
Mr. Whittakin, this is Dr. Campbell. I do have a question as to why when we heard this in December, why neither you or Dr. Delacruz were present at the meeting?
decree, the proposed consent decree came out, I believe, Heather, you can correct me if I'm wrong, we received that in January.
Correct, but the meeting was held in December, and neither you or he were in attendance at that meeting when you were invited.
I believe that was for Dr. Brewer, who was also involved in the case, and I believe I was there in person for that hearing. And the...
pardon me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so this is the informal hearing is to address the proposed consent decree, which we did not get until January. So that's what we were responding to. And we did agree in February to be there in person, but I'm sorry, I did not catch that.
This is Heather Broaddus, Madam Chair, board members, and Mr. Whittakin. Just to clarify, 1930B, Eugene De La Cruz was initially reviewed by the board at its December 11th, 2019 meeting, and that is the meeting in which the board voted to offer the consent agreement and decree of censure. Due to the drafting of the consent agreement by the board's assistant attorney general, and you know, everybody is busy during the holiday season, it took until the beginning mid-January until I was able to send that consent agreement, offered consent agreement and decree of censure out. So that's where the January date is coming in. So I just wanted to provide that clarification.
Anything else, Mr. Whittakin?
Not unless anybody has questions. Thank you.
Dr. Yolano, Dr. Foreman, or Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions for Mr. Whittakin?
No, if we move this to July, it would be a warmer date. Possibly this virus has subsided a little bit. Would that be time enough for De La Cruz to get everything together?
Absolutely, in 30 days would be fine, but the projections are not so rosy when it comes to that. But yeah, it's not a matter of the time. I can prepare for this, you know, within a matter of a week or 30 days easily. It's just a matter of doing our presentation to the board and being there in person to answer the questions and share whatever pertinent documents are necessary, because they are pretty extensive records.
Mr. Whittakin, this is Dr. Campbell again. So depending on what happens, if Governor Ducey extends any orders and we have any changes and things, are you amenable to participating telephonically for that meeting, for that informal?
Well, it depends on what the governor is telling us to do or not to do. But certainly I would like the opportunity to meet with Dr. De La Cruz to prepare him. One of the other problems with these hearings, and it's not the board's fault, is the last time I was there, we started at 8:30, and I think we got to Dr. Brewer at about 11:30. So, yes, we're given whatever the situation is at that time. If Dr. De La Cruz and I are sitting 6 to 10 feet apart, that's fine. We would like to get this done. The board, I'm sure, would like to get this done. We just want to have a fair opportunity to make our presentations and answer the board's questions.
Oh, I understand that, but what I asked was, would you be amenable to participating telephonically in that situation?
If this situation continues for another several months, yes, I would be prepared to do that. It's not ideal, but that will give me more time to work with Dr. De La Cruz. We might be able to Skype to prepare and do things of that nature, but certainly we would certainly be prepared to, we would be amenable to do that. Hopefully that won't be necessary. I'm hoping we're able to meet each other socially well before then.
With this, John Roach, with this not being an emergency, I would say to extend it to June, July, and let the attorney prepare.
Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. But Mr. Whittakin just mentioned that he thought it wouldn't take him that long to be prepared, and that's, I think he was, we all seem to be comfortable with a 30-day time frame, so. And we can always extend it if there are other issues that occur. Any other remarks from any other board members?
I would say 60 days. Is it Dr. Foreman? I would say at least 60 days instead of the 30, because I understand he wants to present in front of us with the questions instead of telephonically, because it's not the same telephonically. So I would move this out 60 days.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Yes, and Heather has to have 35 days to notice for the informal hearing, so 60 days would be appropriate. So do I have a motion on this, or does anybody else have any questions or comments, Heather?
Madam Chair, board members, and Mr. Whittakin, this is Heather Rodas. I would just like to point out that the meeting in June is scheduled for June 10th. So I just wanted to make Mr. Whittakin aware of that now for any potential scheduling issues he or Dr. De La Cruz may have.
Actually, I was supposed to be in trial on June 10th, but that has already been continued. So I suspect my calendar will be open.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
This is Dr. Foreman. I'll make a motion to table case 1930B informal hearing till the June 10th meeting.
I second it. John Rhodes.
All right. Any other discussion on this? Okay, we'll take our voice vote. Dr. Foreman.
Aye.
Dr. Yolano.
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. So moved. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, and stay well.
Thank you, you too. So we will go back to the item A for the informal hearing that had been scheduled. So I will... make a motion to vacate. Do I need to do that? Does that say vacate this? Because we voted on the other way, it doesn't.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, all right. So we have to, no further action then on that since we voted to move that to 60 days. All righty. Next, we have under 5. B, we have our investigation files. The investigation file that is here today for review was investigated by Dr. Polakoff. It's the complaint number 19-40-C, which is Dr. Devin Bland. We have Dr. Bland on the phone with his attorney, Mr. Flynn Carey. We also have the complainant MG present on the phone with her counsel, Mr. Aaron Hall. And we also have Dr. Polakoff, who is the investigator. So Dr. Polakoff will give her report first, and somebody needs, there's a lot of background noise, so please check your phones and make sure things are on mute. Thank you. So Dr. Polakoff, when you're ready.
I am. Good morning, board. This is Dr. Deidre Polakoff, investigator for case 1940C, Devin Bland. I did review the case, and I did speak to MG, the complainant, several times to update this concern. The complaint summary is Dr. Devin Bland performed surgery on this patient several times. Her name is MG. She initiated a complaint alleging negligent surgery on her by Dr. Bland, and that she was not informed for use of cadaver bone products. He did not address the foot drop tendon transplant, which was planned. and I did not respond to her phone calls for pain medication. The patient was previously seen by another podiatrist who diagnosed her with a foot drop and suggested a tendon transplant surgery. Dr. Bland saw her before surgery, and the patient at this time was always under the understanding that it was a foot drop procedure. When she awoke from surgery, she had surgery for her heel and her bunion area, which she did not really feel that affected the foot drop procedure. She was always concerned why those two areas were performed with a surgical intervention as opposed to the tendon transplant. During her hospital stay, she was not seen by Dr. Bland for 4 days post-op, and she felt that every time she asked someone where he was, no one seemed to know. The patient was given prescriptions for pain medication, but when she was ready to leave the hospital, the pharmacy could not fill the pain medications because, according to the pharmacist's note, they were written for the wrong strength of the medication. The patient had severe pain postoperatively and burning. She called Dr. Bland but had no response. She did end up going to the emergency room. It is noted in the emergency room records that for 3 hours they tried to phone Dr. Bland, but he did not respond back. And another doctor was phoned, who I believe was an orthopedist, and he diagnosed her wound as a severe burn, a wound dehiscence, and he prescribed pain medication and antibiotics. The patient was still under the understanding that she was supposed to be treated for a foot drop, and to this day, she still does not understand why that procedure did not go and what happened to the tendon transplant. In review of the notes, there is documentation from the hospital pharmacist as to trying to contact Dr. Bland and to the ER department trying to contact Dr. Bland, both with no response back. I'm going to leave the responses for these concerns to Mr. Flynn Carey as to why Dr. Bland had concerns for these, why the patient still has concerns for these areas, and maybe he could answer them. The records are complete for everything I received for the medical records. We did have to send to Tuba City for medical records multiple times with subpoenas, and the charts came back in dribs and drabs. Until now, I do believe that we have everything, and it was all reviewed except for the on-call records for 2017-18. We did receive on-call records for Dr. Bland 2019, which did not apply to this case at all. Does the board have any questions?
Gentlemen, do you have any questions for Dr. Polakoff?
No.
Dr. Polakoff, I read on the notes that there was a joint commission investigation, and Dr. Bland was cleared from this. Can you elaborate on that?
Actually, I'm going to leave that, if it's okay with the board, to Mr. Flynn Carey, and he has all the notes on that.
Okay.
So, Dr. Polakoff, did you not receive that report?
I did receive it. But I, if you don't mind, for the board, I think that Mr. Flynn, I did discuss this with Mr. Flynn Carey, and I think that he could sum it up for the board completely.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that I was in complete understanding of that.
You were, and in my preparation, I did speak with both with MG and the attorney, and that's why I think it's important that the attorney responds to this part of it.
Correct. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Since we don't have any further questions right now for Dr. Polakoff, we will now hear from the complainant, MG, and her attorney, Mr. Aaron Hall. So, Mr. Hall, I don't know if you are planning to speak on behalf of your client first or have MG give us a summary. And again, somebody needs to mute their phone because we're getting a lot of background. Thank you. Mr. Hall?
Yes, Madam Chair and board members. My intention was to just ask MG a series of questions about what took place and then make a brief statement, and then MG would like to make a brief statement as well.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Okay. MG, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. How long did you treat with Dr. Bland?
Before my procedure, over a year.
Okay. And how many times would you say you saw him over that year?
At least 8 or 10 times.
Okay. Did you, in any time when you were treating with Dr. Bland, did you ever discuss with him your flat feet?
No.
Did you ever discuss with him your bunion?
No.
Did you ever discuss with him the heel misalignment in your right foot?
No.
Okay. And how long, to your knowledge, have you had those three conditions?
I was born with it.
Okay. Did any of those conditions cause you problems where they result in pain?
No.
Okay. Did they cause any other problems?
No.
You know, difficulty walking or anything like that?
No.
Okay. And Dr. Bland prescribed you some treatments for your condition. What sort of treatment did he prescribe for you, or did he treat you with? What did he do for you while you treated with him over that year?
I went to physical therapy. I tried a numerous braces. Those didn't help.
Were those two? What was your understanding of what those treatments were for? What were they to address? What condition?
My drop foot.
Okay. Were any of them successful?
No.
Okay. Why'd you ultimately decide to undergo the surgical procedure that Dr. Bland performed on you?
My shuffling was getting worse.
You're shuffling,
and tripping.
And tripping. Okay. And what did you feel the cause of the shuffling? And when you say shuffling, you mean the way you walked? You had to shuffle when you walked.
My gait.
Okay. And what was the cause, in your mind, what was the cause of the shuffling?
The drop foot.
The drop foot. And did you share that with Dr. Bland, that you felt the cause of your shuffling and the tripping was a result of the drop foot?
Well, it was already diagnosed before I started seeing Dr. Bland by another podiatrist. After that podiatrist left, I started seeing Dr. Bland.
Okay.
I was diagnosed in 2016 with a drop foot.
Okay. And, I'll move on. Did Dr. Bland ever, I'll move on. I'll skip that too. When you had a pre-op appointment with Dr. Bland, what did you discuss with him?
The tendon transfer for the dropped foot, and he was going to infuse three of my bones from my big toes. And he just explained he was going to do some other procedure by my ankle. I don't know the, you tell me the technical term for the medical term, but I don't know what the real terms for those procedures were. He just explained he was going to go do this, this, and that, and that he was going to place a wedge in my foot. And that was it. He didn't tell me specifically what it was, just like in plain language that someone could understand that's not in the medical field. That's not a
prior doctor. To the pre-op appointment you had with Dr. Bland, did you ever discuss these procedures with him before?
The tendon transfer, yes.
Okay, but the heel alignment, the midfoot fusion, the toe correction. You never discussed those. He never brought those up in your recollection.
No.
Pardon me, Mr. Hall. This is Dr. Campbell. I just need to ask a quick question. With your interviewing here of the patient, would you say that that will give the information that she would present in her summary, so that we can combine this together that way?
She was not going to give a summary. If the board would prefer that I just simply summarize what took place, I'm happy to just state that.
Thank you. I think that would be very helpful. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. I'm happy to do that. So the board, I think, got a clear impression of what happened here is that essentially MG was treating for some time for her drop foot. If the board goes through the records and looks at them closely, they'll see that over and over and over again, every single appointment, the focus of the complaint and by the patient and the issue that was being treated was the drop foot. That was the primary focus. She went to the pre-op appointment. Dr. Bland started discussing all of these other items. She was under the assumption that these were all related to the drop foot, that these were to correct the drop foot. She did not ask those questions when she was, how does this impact my drop foot? Because her understanding that this was all related and that she trusted her doctor to make the decisions about what was appropriate treatment for the condition for which she was seeking help for in this case. The wedge issue, he did discuss with her that he was going to be using a wedge with the heel alignment issue. She assumed at the time, she didn't really think about it at the time, I think, but assumed that it would be some sort of a synthetic wedge. She did not understand that it was going to be a cadaver bone. And I think a lot of that has to do with the context of her, where she was and who she is. And I'll get to that a little bit further along. But essentially, she did not understand what the surgery was and what the surgery was for. It was poorly explained to her and not ever explained to her why it was connected to or supposed to correct the drop foot issue. After the surgery, when she asked Dr. Bland about the tendon transfer, he said her recollection was that he said the tendon was damaged, and therefore he didn't do the tendon transfer. But if you look at the operation notes from the surgery, there's nothing about any kind of examination of a tendon. Nothing indicating that it was examined and that it was determined to be too damaged to do the tendon transfer. So I'm not entirely sure what was done there. I don't think there's any evidence that to suggest that the tendon was transferred, and I think that evidence, in fact, suggests to the opposite, and her current podiatrist does not believe there's any damage to the tendon whatsoever that would have prevented the tendon transfer that was indicated in the procedure that she underwent that day. As far as the cadaver bone goes, I think this is a cultural sensitivity issue that, you know, probably in most podiatrist practices and not something they would consider or think about too much, but you have to understand the context that we're dealing with. Now, Tuba City Regional Health is a what's called, it operates under a self-determination contract. That's a 638 contract is oftentimes what it's referred to, meaning it used to be an IHS facility, an Indian Health Services facility. It is now a wholly owned operation of the Navajo Nation, but it receives 100% of its funding basically from the federal government through IHS. And so for all intents and purposes, it's a federal facility, but it's operates on the Navajo Nation in Tuba City, and pretty much 100% of its patients are Native American, and of those, the vast majority are Navajo. Navajo have the Navajo people have very specific beliefs around death and how to handle dead bodies. These are widely held beliefs. These are well-known beliefs to anybody who has had any interaction with the Navajo culture would be well aware of that. And certainly anyone who is practicing on the Navajo Nation medically should be well aware of those concerns about the use of a cadaver bone on a patient at a facility treating Navajo people. Now, throughout her records, you also find that everywhere it indicates that she's a traditional Navajo. All of the forms, when it describes her belief system, set forth that she's a traditional Navajo. So it was well aware to anyone treating her, anyone reviewing her chart, that she was a traditional Navajo, and that she would be extremely sensitive to any issues related to this cadaver bone issue. So the fact that was done without discussing the specifics of what that cadaver bone was and what it meant, I think, led to pretty significant harm of MG in this case. And the reason for that is, and her father, who is a medicine man in Navajo, she went to him to do what's after the bone was removed in a subsequent surgery, she went to him to do a cleansing prayer and ceremony. But he's unable to actually do the cleansing prayer and ceremony. And the reason for that is because in order to do it properly, he needs to know more about the decedent. And for privacy laws, they can't get that information. They need to know how he died, who he was, and other things in order to say a prayer for the decedent, as well as in order to cleanse the MG in this case. And because of privacy laws, obviously they can't get that information. So she's stuck with this. She's stuck with this issue. Now, as far as the the issues, the on-call issues and everything, it was her expectation that Dr. Bland was going to be available. She was never told that he wasn't going to be available after the surgery, that there was supposed to be somebody else. I don't think there was ever any clear instructions to anybody else, because everybody else seemed quite surprised by the fact that they were supposed to be dealing with MG's case after the surgery was over, and it's my understanding that Dr. Bland's defense to that is that, you know, he wasn't on call, and there were other people supposed to be handling that. That was never made clear to her, and obviously from the confusion in the notes, I don't think anybody else was aware of that. So I think there was lack of instruction to whoever was supposed to take up the responsibility of writing her prescriptions and ensuring that any issues post-op were being taken care of. So that's my summary of the facts of the case. I do think, I don't know if I'm going to be able to sort of address the legal points here now, or if I'd have another opportunity to do that later, but I do have additional argument and summation about what I believe the legal issues are, if the board would want to hear those now.
Now, at this time, that's not appropriate for...
okay. Thank you. I'll end it there.
Yes, but I have a question for you, for MG, actually, about the Parkinson's. Is she currently under treatment for that? And is she aware that, you know, she describes a shuffling gait, that is a gait pattern in people with Parkinson's?
Yes, I'm aware of that. That was just disclosed to me with my neurologist.
So do you see your neurologist on a regular basis, ma'am?
Yes, I do, and I'm on medication for that, for the Parkinson's.
Thank you. Do any of my other board members have any questions for Mr. Hall and MG, please? Or comments?
John Rhodes, I have a question. In the Native American communities, especially the Navajo, they don't believe in blood transfusions. And did not MG agree in her to have blood transfusions if it was necessary?
MG, you can go ahead and answer that.
Yes, I did agree, but the blood is not from a deceased person.
Okay, I was just reading that it said that the Navajo, no blood transfusions are allowed.
It depends on the case, but for me, because it's not from a deceased person, I will get a blood transfusion.
Thank you very much. If there are no other questions or comments at this time, now we will be hearing from Dr. Bland and his attorney, Mr. Flynn Carey. So, Mr. Carey, do you want to give a summary and then?
Yes, President Campbell, I appreciate it. So, first of all, it's apparent, you know, I've lived with this case and Dr. Polakoff's lived with this case for a pretty significant period of time. And I think it was very telling in Mr. Hall's comments. I'll take one example, the drop foot issue. August 6th, note, 2018. Today, her right ankle is painful. She's having a hard time walking. She questions if she has dropped foot. I mean, the reality here is I've dug into this file for months, and we've had this reviewed. Dr. Polakoff reviewed it. Other individuals have reviewed it. The reality here is that this is not a case where he did multiple surgeries. He did one surgery. He inherited this patient from another podiatrist who incorrectly diagnosed a drop foot. That MG then went AMA for about a year. When she returned, she then worked with Dr. Bland. At that point, he disagreed with the drop foot diagnosis. He used Johnson and Strom framework to support his conclusion, and he based his conclusions on that framework, and he performed a surgery for which he had informed consent. All the follow-up care for which he was responsible for was satisfied. There are essentially three allegations here. There's a lack of consent. The claim that she consented to drop foot and instead had a flat foot performed. The claim that there was a failure of responding to her when she was hospitalized on an emergent basis. And then there's this issue of use of human bioproduct or cadaverous tissue during surgery. All of these should be unsubstantiated. I want to note something because Dr. Polakoff mentioned it. We made requests. We don't have subpoena power at this stage. I don't have the ability to subpoena anything. So the board was kind enough through Ms. Broaddus to entertain a list of items that I had requested. And unfortunately, Tuba City did come short here. For instance, our position is that Dr. Bland was scheduled for out-of-state travel during the September hospitalization when MG was admitted. We asked for the schedules to prove that, and we got the 2019 instead of the 2018 schedules. We asked for other materials that we felt would support our position, and those were not produced. The things that were produced were actually very probative to the extent that they could be, and they helped support our conclusions that there was no violation of the standard of care. But the reality is that the board needs to take the materials it has before it right now, and those definitely find in favor of Dr. Bland. I want to turn to the allegations. First one is this lack of consent issue. Dr. Goss, not Dr. Bland, in 2016 diagnosed drop foot. This is not a drop foot. In fact, MG herself acknowledged that she was having doubts as of August of 2018 whether she even had drop foot. This was a flat foot. Dr. Bland made the correct diagnosis. The plan of care, the surgery consent is that she signed is very clear. She got the procedure that she agreed to. And was it the correct procedure? Yes. Dr. Bland documented why he chose the procedure. We provided the Johnson and Strom literature in support of it. And an independent review specifically found that flat foot was the appropriate surgery for the condition. Again, the Johnson and Strom stages and the substage that was relied upon was used here. The tendon transfer is a red herring in this case. Dr. Bland specifically wrote that it was a possible tendon transfer. He accounted for the fact that that might be necessary. However, ultimately, he decided not to go forward with the tendon transfer. It was determined upon review of this case that the tendon transfer was not appropriate, and it wasn't, and it didn't occur. So you can't, the standard of care should not create a situation where the doctor recognizes the possibility of a surgical need, and then when they get into the surgery or they are preparing for the surgery, there's a determination that that surgical need is not there. We shouldn't try to create a public policy that compels surgeons to do an unnecessary surgery there. The review, independent review, indicated that the tendon transfer was a possible sub-procedure, but agreed with Dr. Bland's ultimate decision. For the patient abandonment claim, he was not on call. He was not scheduled. I think it was very telling when Mr. Hall said, well, there seemed to be some confusion. It is not the board's purpose to put confusion within a hospital, especially when there's an ortho and another podiatrist available, as noted in the record, on Dr. Bland. He properly was not on call and was not on schedule that day. This is a teaching hospital. It is very appropriate that there will be a variety of people involved in the care of someone. And Dr. Bland was not on call that day. I wish we had the schedules, but unfortunately, those have not been produced for those dates. From a due process perspective, I would ask you to find that the burden hasn't been met on the patient abandonment because the materials are just not there. Finally, we have this human bioproduct claim. First of all, I think it's telling that that Mr. Hall acknowledges with his client that this is not the normal. It is not normal to have this issue. That's just accurate. That's correct. It is not normal that we are having that level of discussion with individuals. There's really two ways to look at this one. We have provided you essentially a 9-point rebuttal on this cadaverous tissue, and you can adopt some of them, all of them. Ultimately, you can select a few of them, but every single one results in a finding that there was no violation. First of all, the implant was scaffolded. It's mineral deposit. It is not actual bone. It's not dead tissue. It's essentially a lattice work. So the idea that this is against the Navajo beliefs is just simply not accurate. I didn't have this in my presentation previously, but since Mr. Hall brought it up, if she did go to the DNA, to someone to do a ceremony, which, for the reasons I'll set forth, I don't think it was necessary. She's given the information as to the approximate age, the fact that it's a female donor, and additional information. But setting that aside, the records show here that Dr. Bland did an extensive pre-op workup. He had extensive discussions with MG, and he charted those interactions. The records are very clear that he spent a significant amount of time with her. I'd note that MG is a CNA. She appears sophisticated about podiatric procedures to the point that she's expressing skepticism about drop foot, and is correct that there's not a drop foot here. Fourth, the consent talks about amnion. Again, human bioproduct. It does not make sense that she would consent to some human bioproducts and others she would not. As one of the board members indicated, she consented to blood transfusion. The board member is correct. That is in contradiction of Navajo beliefs to use blood transfusions. Sixth, we've provided you a polygraph confirming that Dr. Bland did discuss the fact that human bioproducts would be used in the procedures. Seventh, she claims that she had a further procedure to remove the bone, but the lattice integrates. So this idea that there's something to remove there, I just think is false. In addition, we believe that the record speaks for itself on human bioproducts. We presented in our response the fact that the subsequent doctor who performed surgery on her after used demineralized bone matrix. That's a putty, and used amnion. Those are human bioproducts again. So she's expressed this concern about the use of human bioproduct, but her subsequent procedures are again using human bioproduct. It really calls into question, is this a firmly held belief? And it also supports the position that Dr. Bland did in fact instruct her about this. So you can look at those eight items, and any of those items allow the board to conclude that there was not a violation here. Dr. Bland did, in fact, instruct her about the use of human bioproduct, and she consented to it. There is adequate paperwork and adequate records to confirm that. But there's also another issue here, which is the policymaking issue. And the board would have to go into policymaking territory to find against Dr. Bland on this consent issue. The literature supports a conclusion that a patient bears the burden to tell a clinician about beliefs or cultural norms that the patient wants the clinician to follow. We've provided literature from the AMA. We've indicated that it's not only not the burden on the clinician to inquire about these culturally held beliefs, but in fact it can damage the clinician-patient relationship if that becomes a matter of course that someone is inquiring. Now, we're not taking the position that MG can't hold a particular belief, but if there's a belief that impacts care, it's upon the patient to communicate that. It's our position that consent was obtained here, and the record supports that. But let's suppose it wasn't. Let's just go off on this road. If he is disciplined for not asking every person, if they are Navajo, if they are a Jehovah's Witness, if they are a Christian Scientist, if they are a Zoroastrian, then it's sending a message to practitioners that they have to adopt a new level of care that is not contemplated with how we are teaching people in schools and not contemplated by the professional conduct rules. The standard taught in the clinical community is that there is a burden on patients to disclose their cultural beliefs. It's why the Jehovah's Witnesses and Christian Scientists have cards in their wallet that explain the fact that they cannot do blood transfusions. It's why Zoroastrians have requirements that they can do blood transfusions but can't donate tissues. I'm not saying the board can't at some point adopt a global cultural awareness requirement or adopt some kind of policy statement that it can send out as a board. But this, it would not be fair to use Dr. Bland's case to punish him in this situation due to this cultural issue. I think in reality, though, the board should be able to conclude from these materials, from any of the 9 points we have laid out and that we have documented to the hilt in our responses, that he met the cultural requirements, he met the informed consent requirements. In conclusion here, there is no failure of consent. He indicated once he received this patient who had gone AMA for a year prior, he looked at her with fresh eyes, he made a diagnosis that is supported by a review, and that has been supported, that has been determined by a reviewer to be the correct procedure. She signed off on that procedure. She signed off on the use of bioproducts. She got the procedure that she contracted for with this professional. There is nothing here that indicates that the wrong procedure was done or that he lacked consent. And the cultural issues for the 9 reasons that I have laid out also should cut in Dr. Bland's favor. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know Dr. Bland is on the phone and also happy to answer any questions the board has.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. I will ask my other board members if they have questions first. So, Dr. Ulano, Dr. Foreman, or Mr. Rhodes?
John Rhodes. With there being over 500 Native American nations, they all have different religious beliefs, languages, and customs. I think it would be fairly unreasonable for and out of the norm for every doctor working to have to ask someone what their religious beliefs are before they do surgery on them. Am I not right?
This is Aaron Hall on behalf of
Mr. Hall, pardon me. This is Mr. Carey and Dr. Bland's time. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And I would, and thank you, President Campbell. I would just object. He's served his role as the advocate for MG. It's, obviously this is a complaint that's been lodged and we want to respond. I agree, to the board member who asked that question. The reality is that the standard of care right now is patient driven. There's actually articles that we cited that indicate from the AMA that the AMA has published in its journal indicating that from a cultural standpoint, you can actually damage the client relationship or the patient relationship by probing religious beliefs in that way. And I agree, I'm not as familiar with the Navajo and the Diné beliefs to the extent where I could put myself as an expert. I have familiarity from other cases and other involvement with the Navajo. What I would say is there are variations. And, as one of the board members correctly noted, MG has adopted a position that she'll accept the blood transfusion when the standard the default is that Navajo do not allow blood transfusions. And so I agree that I think it would be unwieldy and inappropriate. It's also why people who do hold these beliefs have these fail-safes in place, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses with their blood transfusion cards and the Zoroastrians who will not allow for to be donors for any kind of medical procedure after they pass.
Thank you. Dr. Ulano or Dr. Foreman? I have a question for Dr. Bland. Dr. Bland, do you think your operative report was adequate in the description of the surgeries you performed?
Thank you for allowing me to speak, Madam Chair. I do.
And do you think that the description on your consent form could have possibly been confusing to the patient? I'm talking about the actual diagnosis portion where all that's written there is chronic right foot pain.
So respectfully, when I consented MG, I was very direct in the language that I chose to put on my actual consent outlining the procedure that would be carried out. Now, the reason for choosing chronic right foot pain is there has been a history of misdiagnosis and regarding this patient and what her actual presentation was. I felt that the Johnson & Strom stage 2 flat foot was outlined in my operative report, and I chose the appropriate procedure to treat that pathology. Furthermore, in the preoperative planning, I brought a plastic foot model into the room, and I showed her exactly where the osteotomies, bone cuts, would be made. And you'll notice that I used the medical term as well as the lay term. And so to say that somebody was unsure, I will use terms such as shin bone, ankle bone, heel bone, so that there is no confusion. And I absolutely say what the product that I will implant in the form of bone graft is by calling it cadaver tissue. So there's no confusion as to what it is, what the purpose of it, and why it's going into the patient.
So, Dr. Bland, what I was remarking about was the actual consent form that was in there, that was taken at the surgery site, not in your clinic or office situation. Do you do diagrams in addition to using the plastic foot model?
Tuba City is not set up to do diagrams, so we do not. That's why I chose to use the plastic foot model.
Okay. My concern, again, goes back to the consent form that was signed in the hospital where it just says the chronic right foot pain. There's nothing on there about, you know, flat foot, it's not, or anything about the HAV that you described as occurring because of, obviously, the mechanics that had occurred over the years. So that's where my question is. And on that form, too, typically writing lay terms on there in addition to the medical terminology is quite, you know, quite typical, not just in what you describe in your office or clinic notes.
Mm-hmm. I did, I mean, I wrote lay terms on that consent where it says first, I've got first spelled out, written. I mean, this was all discussed in great detail, and that was documented after each clinic visit, saying that the questions were answered to the patient's satisfaction.
Do you ever ask the patient, or did you ask this patient, in her own words, to tell you what she saw her diagnosis as and what you were going to do, to repeat that back to you? Because I know you've commented that all questions were answered and all that, so, but I just want to know, do you do that?
The answer to that would be yes, and I feel that that's supported in the form of a polygraph test that I passed, because, you know, if there's any doubt, any concern, anything that wasn't presented to the patient by her own understanding, then I think that would have negated me from passing that polygraph test.
Thank you. Yolano?
And I'm
sorry. Oh, pardon me. I did not know you were not finished, Dr. Bland. Pardon me.
No, that's totally fine. That's just the difficulty of being on the phone here. That was actually discussed on multiple occasions, not just one, not just in the preoperative area. That conversation was had multiple times.
Dr. Campbell, if I may.
I've got a question for Dr. Bland. In regards to the abandonment, just understand from you were going to be going out of state at that time. Being this is a teaching hospital, were there multiple redundancies and coverage for you being out of town? And was this notated by you or by the hospital?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Dr. Ilana. I appreciate you bringing that up. So we've alluded to the fact that it is a teaching hospital. Now, I would not feel comfortable being out of state, leaving a resident, no matter what year they are, or a physician's assistant, which I had at the time, to round and see patients. So the lack in documentation is my colleague, Dr. Barden, was on call. Furthermore, podiatry in that facility falls under the orthopedics department, and so an orthopedic surgeon would have been a backup to Dr. Barden had there been something beyond his scope or his level of comfort. So we absolutely had somebody available to see, attend to, answer questions, round all of those issues.
And I would add, this is Flynn Carey, even though the schedules that we were given were from 2019 and therefore are not probative about these specific dates, I would note that you can actually see the ortho and the podiatrist on those schedules. And so typically, and this is actually, Tuba City has now moved to a system where the ortho is the on-call person. So they don't really do podiatry on-call anymore. They do ortho on-call. But you can see even from 2019, there are two bands on those calendars of coverage of on-call individuals. So I cannot give you an explanation for why there was internal confusion at Tuba City. What I can say, and I think that there's no evidence to rebut, is that, you know, Dr. Bland had pre-scheduled out of state travel, which was documented at the time, and there was a breakdown of some sort within either the ER or within the on-call schedule or on-call process, because there were certainly individuals, including Dr. Bardeen and others, who could have managed this situation.
And respectfully, if I can just add to that, I was called numerous times when I was not on call, given the fact that there is confusion at that hospital. It's hard for them to call the correct person on call. And I went in and saw patients when I myself was not on the list. So it does happen.
That's not another question. Can you expand on the prescription? Your explanation on how that happened with the prescription?
So that comes from the patient saying that she was allergic to Percocet originally. We tried to write for Norco. And then if you, as you go through the documentation, she later said that she is not allergic to Percocet. So that was the confusion. Was she or was she truly not allergic to Percocet per her own admission?
And there was also a confusion in regards to filling the prescription or the pharmacy trying to get a hold. Was it you or the doctor on call who was confused, or there was confusion about the prescription?
It was the pharmacist who was confused, and they were calling the incorrect phone number.
Were they calling the doctor on call at that point, or
they were,
or they trying,
no,
to
they
call
were,
you?
They were trying to call me, but I was not on call.
Okay, and they had the wrong number in regards to calling you.
They thought that they were calling the on-call doctor, but they were using my phone number. And as Mr. Carey's alluded to, in myself, I was away from my phone for a three-hour period, after which time I tried to call them back, and I it was after hours, and so nobody answered.
Okay, I have no further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Yolano. Well, I think we've had a very thorough discussion and hearing from everyone. So I have a statement or summary that I'd like to present. So just bear with me, please. We are tasked with determining in these allegations from the complainant MG made against Dr. Bland are they valid and therefore substantiated, which indicates a potential violation of state statutes, or number two, is this invalid and therefore not substantiated, and then there being no violation of state statutes. We have Dr. Polakoff's initial investigator's report from December of 2019. It should be noted that Dr. Bland did not respond to the subpoena for records, and by the direction of the board's AAG, Frankie Shin-Eckberg, the investigation moved forward. Dr. Polakoff substantiated the allegations based upon the information from Tuba City and the complainant. Dr. Bland was remiss in not responding to the board in the appropriate manner. He is licensed by the State of Arizona Board of Podiatry Examiners and has been since 12-14 of 2016. Dr. Bland took the jurisprudence exam as part of the requirements for licensure and also attested that he had read and understood state statutes. It was his responsibility to respond. If Dr. Bland had responded to the board, then Dr. Polakoff would have interviewed him, and her report would most likely have had a different tone. As we can see, Dr. Polakoff submitted an updated report on 3/23 of 20. Dr. Polakoff was doing her job with what she had to work with. Dr. Bland, I'd like to remind you that failure to respond to the board violates ARS 32-854.01, number 18. Refusing to divulge to the board upon demand the means, method, procedure, modality of treatment or medicine used in the treatment of a disease, injury, ailment, or infirmity. It should be noted that there was difficulty getting information from Tuba City, and this affected this board as well as Dr. Bland and his counsel, Mr. Glenn Carey. After reviewing all presented materials, Dr. Polakoff's reports, Dr. Bland's materials, MG's materials, and the hearing, and hearing from each party, and having the ability to ask all parties questions, we should have further discussion if necessary, and then adjudicate this case. Mr. Flynn Carey also presented in his materials discussions regarding additional allegations that were not initially included in Dr. Polakoff's report. I myself have no concerns regarding the technical performance of the surgery or its appropriateness for the patient's condition. I do have concerns regarding communication and documentation, as well as Dr. Bland's disregard for his responsibility to respond to this board. I believe that the materials presented to us indicate that allegations made by the complainant against Dr. Bland are unfounded, including the following: the negligent surgery, abandonment, the consenting of an allograft and others, the prescription error, an insurance fraud issue, and the incompatibility of hardware or allergies. Again, my concern regarding communication and documentation are this. The surgical consent form at the hospital is confusing. In the diagnosis section, that all it is written is the right chronic foot pain. No mention of a flat foot or the hallux abducto valgus when in fact the performance of the calcaneal osteotomy and first MPJ fusion were performed. I believe the consent form should include wording in both medical terms and lay terminology to help avoid confusion. I believe, too, that the operative report is very vague. There is no mention of using fluoro or x-ray to confirm surgical repair. I think another doctor should be able to read the report and understand what was done and understand the doctor's thought process. There appears to be poor communication and ultimately confusion from many sources with medical terms, again, going back to the discussion about drop foot or flat foot. I'd like to make a suggestion that you ask a patient to tell you in their own words how they understand or what their podiatric problem is and what can be done for them. I realize also that you have residents involved in the care of patients, but as I see it, you're still the captain of the ship, and I believe you have the responsibility to speak to the patient postoperatively after the effects of an anesthesia were worn off. It also been noted in your records that you had a detailed conversation with the patient, but there are no specific details actually charted, specifically detailed lists of risk and complications and diagrams of proposed procedures. And I'm aware that you just let us know that you used the plastic foot model, but no diagrams. The only consent in the record is the one signed the day of surgery, and again, in experience, it seems it's best to have the preoperative discussion with proper informed consent signed in the clinic or office, in addition to keeping this or having this in the patient's records. A copy can be given to a patient, and this, again, I think can be very helpful in preventing the issue of the doctor said, the patient said. Thank you. Anybody else have any remarks they'd like to make before we proceed with adjudication?
I agree with you. This is Dr. Foreman. I agree with you, Dr. Campbell, about I'd like to see something more than right chronic foot pain in the consent form, because that can mean a lot of things. You can say probable or possible in the diagnosis. It's a little vague.
That's very well said, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you very much, Joe. Yeah,
thank you.
So great. Gentlemen, what is your are your feelings on this? I really do have issue, again, like I said, with failure to respond to a board order, especially when, you know, that's a very important part. You know, ignoring something like that makes, obviously gives a negative inference to this board as to, you know, what's going on. Is this person trying to hide something, et cetera? And I know when you work in a, you know, you work in another facility, but it still behooves you to respond. It's not to be ignored. And again, like I mentioned, my concerns with communication and documentation. So I see as one option that we have here is, of course, a non-disciplinary form, doing a letter of concern that would address the failure to respond to a board order. And then because it's using it separately, an order, then an interim order for continuing education in the regards to communication and documentation. Now, we also have an option of a disciplinary action, but we first must, that has to move to an informal hearing, and the board would have to make a motion to open a board complaint stating a violation of state statute ARS 32-854.01, number 18. Or we could
board
make, or
Campbell,
we, and then we would make the motion to move that issue to an informal hearing.
And Board Member Campbell, this is Flynn Carey. I didn't know, because the issue of the non-cooperation didn't come up in any of the discussion leading up to your comments. Am I granted leave to just briefly respond on that?
Yes, that's fine.
All right. One thing I would indicate, what just wanted the board to be aware of is actually two things. First of all, I appreciate, because we did discuss this in some detail in, I believe, in January, I appreciate where you're coming from. One of the things I did want to note is the typical procedure prior to this complaint was that the complaints made against a practitioner would be fielded by General Counsel of Tuba City, and they would respond in an omnibus fashion for all practitioners who a complaint had been leveled on for a particular patient. I appreciated the comments that you had. I would note, though, that Dr. Bland at the time did operate under that belief. I'd also note that he did cure the issue. We've provided, I think, a pretty extensive workup, which did allow the board to, it appears, allowed the board to, or at least the President Campbell, to conclude that there weren't violations as to the things that were alleged. So I would note that it has been cured, and I recognize that it caused some delay, but it did not cause prejudice, and it gave the board still an opportunity to fully and fairly adjudicate this matter. So I certainly appreciate that there's a, that the licensee has a duty to respond. I think there were some confounding factors, including how Tuba City instructed its practitioners previously to respond. I would certainly encourage the board, or request the board, to take that into account when determining what kind of outcome would be appropriate.
Thank you. Gentlemen, do my board members have any other comments or feelings one way or the other as how this should be adjudicated?
This is Dr. Foreman. Go ahead, Dr. Yolanda.
John Rhodes, I'd say that we take up this failure to respond to the board in a separate issue. And as far as the ongoing issue of 1940-C, I'd like to make a motion, and my motion would be to dismiss, as I find no violation of state statute or standard of care in 1940-C of Dr. Devin Blant. That would be my motion.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Do we have a second?
I'll second it, Dr. Ulano.
Thank you. Okay, any further discussion on this matter? Any other comments, please? I'm just making sure we're all... So we will take a voice vote here, since it's been moved and seconded, to dismiss this case, 1940-C, finding no violations of state statutes. Dr. Ulano?
Aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. It's been unanimously voted to dismiss this case. Thank you, everyone, very much. All righty, so we will move on here to our next. We have C, malpractice matter submitted in a 2019 renewal application from Dr. Stephen Moore. Ms. Brodus?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Dr. Moore submitted a malpractice matter with his renewal, his 2019 renewal application, and there was not enough information for the board to make a determination at that time. Just recently, I received an order for dismissal with prejudice from Dr. Moore's attorney. So it's brought back before the board to make a determination on this matter. And his renewal was approved and processed by the board at that time as well. And there was a request from the board that he continue to update me on a monthly basis, and you'll see that he did do that. He did update me each month. And that's a brief summary. I can answer any other questions you may have.
So it seems I believe that we, you know, we have enough information regarding this case, and it was settled with prejudice, and that it was determined that there were no violations. There, anybody feel like there were any violations of state statute? It's kind of hard to determine that in some ways because the case was settled, so without or with prejudice.
This is Dr. Foreman. I don't see any violation of state statute for the information that we have.
Correct. Okay. So I would move to anybody else have any comments?
No.
Okay. So
no.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Dr. Ulano?
No comments. I see no violations.
Okay. So then as with regards to Dr. Stephen Moore and his notification of a malpractice matter on his 2019 renewal, I don't think no indication that that this needs to be investigated any further. Because it wasn't even, it wasn't even assigned a number, was it? No.
No, it was not. It was at that time, there was not enough information for the board to open a complaint or make any kind of determination. So it was tabled.
Okay. So again, that I make the motion to that there is no need to open a board complaint on this case, as we have all the information we needed to make our decision. So any second on that?
Second it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other discussion? Take a voice vote. Dr. Ulano?
Yes, second the motion.
No, and I'm asking for a vote now. Thank you. So, Dr. Ulano, your vote?
Yes.
Dr. Foreman?
To table.
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes? Mr. Rhodes?
Yes.
Thank you. I didn't know if you were still there. Dr. Campbell, yes.
Muting and unmuting.
Oh, okay. Not a problem. All right. So now we our next section is the investigator for the State Board of Podiatry Examiners, and I'll let Heather let you know what's going on there.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. The board has actively been searching for more board investigators, and the State Association actually did send out a mass email to all of its members just indicating that the board is actively looking and to contact me if there is any interest. And I received a few emails from licensees, and the one who decided to move forward and submit his CV was Dr. Daniel Saunders. So that's before the board. The last correspondence I had from Dr. Saunders was that he would be present, but I do not believe that he is present telephonically. But if he's present, if he could let us know. So it's up to the board to make a determination as to whether or not it believes that he's qualified to conduct evaluation or investigations for the board.
I know he gave us, you know, it's a very limited, you know, CV, but I personally, I'd like to be able to talk to him and ask him, you know, questions, and you know, so. If we, you know, move this to, you know, continue it next month to be able to schedule a time to talk to him. Does anyone else have issue with that, or do you find what we have here and is enough?
I have no issue tabling until next month.
I would feel it would be appropriate to question and talk to Dr. Saunders.
That's what we, you know, we've done previously, so... I don't need to have a motion for this, but I can just direct. We can just direct Heather to correspond with Dr. Saunders, you know, telling him that, you know, this was on the agenda, but we would like to be able to speak to him because we have questions and we want to know what his questions are too about the responsibilities of this position. Okay, great. Let me go back to the first page here. Let's do our minutes under four. So we have the March 11, 2020 general session board meeting minutes. I did not find any issues. Did any of you find any issues? So I'll make a motion.
Not for me.
Oh, thank you. Pardon me. I'm sorry. So I will make a motion to accept our March 11, 2020 general session board meeting minutes as written.
Seconded.
Thank you. Discussion?
Second.
I think we're okay to just all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
So moved. Okay, then we have our March 11, 2020 executive session board meeting minutes. Again, I did not find any issues. Did any of you?
No.
So I will make motion to accept our March 11, 2020 executive session board meeting minutes as written.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Second.
Thank you. All
aye,
in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. All right, now we'll move to 5E, which is in regards to the issuance of licenses. We have three doctors, Jessica Arnonson, Dr. Bogan Barragao. I hope I pronounce your name correct. I believe he should still be on the phone with us, and Dr. William Barrett. So our first is Dr. Arnonson, and she... is still in her residency in Georgetown and is to graduate on the 30th of June. She did present a program director letter saying that she was in good standing and has met her requirements for graduation and will complete her training on the 30th. So she's had all her boards, but one of my questions here too is with the COVID-19 virus, some residents may have been released early from their residency training, or their residency graduation dates may be postponed, because I believe this application was sent in before the virus situation happened. Is that correct, Heather? You think when it was first submitted?
Madam Chair, board members, the application was received on January 24th, I believe. It actually was received prior to that, October 9th, 2019.
Okay, so
again, this many months for it to become complete.
Oh, okay. Okay, so obviously it had, okay. So I think, you know, that we should ask this applicant to get more information about what's the current standing with her residency, and if they have, you know, some kind of documentation that indicates to us that what they, you know, their requirements were all met, what those were, you know, how many, you know, what their numbers, if they've met all their numbers.
And Madam Chair, board members, this is Heather Broaddus. If I could just clarify, the application was received in October of 2019, but the letter from her program director was received March 30th, 2020, and that is after Governor Ducey issued the state emergency declaration.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question previously.
That's why we had to talk and figure.
Yeah. Question, John Rhodes. With this directive from the president and the governor on residents that were going to graduate this year, if they submit an application to be a full-fledged doctor, should we just go ahead and give it? I'm not sure how that would work.
It's Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. Member Rhodes, as far as licensing goes, the if there are no testing examination sites, then we can give them a temporary provisional license until such time as those sites reopen. But that is really the only leeway that we have. You still have to fulfill every other requirement, and really the executive order only encompasses those who have fulfilled those requirements but aren't allowed to take the exam. So if we have, if the board has what they believe is enough information to make a decision to grant a license or not, then they can move forward.
Mr. Rhodes, this first applicant has passed all her boards, so that's not an issue. It's just the issue of the successful completion of a residency program. So like Dr. Dancho down in Tucson has several of his residents that he has presented really nice detailed documentation that makes it easier to make those decisions. So that's why I think in this instance that we could request that also from this applicant.
Okay, I wasn't sure if that residency after they completed it had been set aside because of this emergency action.
Now, things are happening different in each state. That's what's, you know, kind of gets a little confusing here too, is, you know, because there are actually some states, Pennsylvania being one of them, that students have to have passed Part 3 before they go into their residencies, but all the testing sites are currently closed. So you know, they have to go, you know, that's something they have to do legislatively through their governor to get an executive order. And so, you know, we're just trying to, you know, follow what our current state statutes is and go, obviously go with what Governor Ducey's directives are. So I would just at this time not issue a license to this Dr. Arnonson, but to ask her for more information. Anybody else have any comments on that? Concerns? Now, she is currently licensed in Maryland and Virginia, but those expire on the 30th of June. So that doesn't really help us out, so, or help this young lady out. All right, so we'll move on to our next license application. Dr. Bogda, can you pronounce your name so I don't butcher it?
Sure, it's Bogdan Berigo. I actually just go by Bo. That's a lot easier for most people.
Okay, so you are currently with Dr. Duhuki, correct?
This is correct.
And what is the status of your program? Are you still in the hospital seeing patients, or what have they done with that?
That's a great question. So we cover quite a few hospitals, so it really depends. At Tucson Medical Center, where is our kind of, I guess you could call our home base, we don't do any elective surgeries, but we still can cover emergent cases, and whoever's on call still manages the inpatients, unless it's in the COVID unit. And if it's in the COVID unit, then only the on-call attending goes into those units. Other hospitals, we cannot do anything at, and then other hospitals, we're only allowed to do surgery. So it really depends, but we are still working, correct, yes.
Okay, so they still anticipate your graduation date of 6:30?
Correct, absolutely, yeah. I believe Dr. Duhuki presented a letter stating that I've met all the requirements to complete residency, which include the proper rotations and all the numbers.
So is there, to get a more detailed document from Dr. Duhuki for you that shows all those, so we have that in your file?
Yeah, there's a letter from him stating that everything's completed. And I could easily provide a number from RR states that has been completed. That's what is required.
That would be great. So we can move to accept that upon that receipt of that documentation, and that Heather and I can review it, and then Heather can issue. Heather, did you guys hear that, gentlemen, my board members? I'm sorry, I was asking Seamus if in this situation, you know, with Dr. Bo, that since we do have some information from Dr. Duhuki, but he said he could certainly get us more, that we could move to accept his application and give this gentleman a license after, or issue a license upon receipt of that documentation and review by myself and Heather. Then that would allow, if that's, you know, everything's on the up and up and straight up, that Heather can go ahead and give this gentleman a license.
That sounds good with me.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Good.
Mr. Rhodes?
Yes. Yes, good.
Okay. Yes, okay. So do we have any other questions for Dr. Bo? All right, very good. So you're not in, so you don't go into any of the COVID units?
No, we don't.
Okay. All righty. Well, you're not having to study for any exams either. So this is, and I'm glad you had your, glad you got your part three done. So that's great. All right. So I will make a motion to accept the application for licensure and issue a license for Dr. Bogdan upon receipt of and review of additional documentation indicating requirements that he has completed that would be, include things like his surgical numbers in more detail for us. And that when that's received, that Heather and I will review that, and then if everything's fine, then Heather can issue a license. Kind of roundabout winded there, but I apologize. So do I have a second?
Seconded.
Seconded.
Any other discussion there? So we will take a voice vote. Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Iolano?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. Mr. Rhodes?
Aye.
Aye. Very good. It's been moved and seconded and passed unanimously. All right. So, Dr. Bogdan, I'll just have you keep up with your communication here with Heather, and then we'll be able to move forward. And thank you for participating.
Will do. Thank you, sir. Absolutely. Have a great day.
Thank you. Be safe. All right. Our last applicant is Dr. William Barrett. I don't know, Dr. Iolano wasn't with us at that time, but obviously Dr. Foreman and Mr. Rhodes were on the board. This, we went through an application process with this doctor before he was issued a license in December 18 of 18, and let it expire on the expired on the 31st of August of 19. So he has made an application again. He did pay his fees. Presented a clean license from Utah. Any other comments on that, Heather, or anything else anybody should be? Do you remember this, Dr. Foreman and Mr. Rhodes?
Somewhat.
Okay. All righty. We had had the issues with training and residency issues before as far as his, if it was commensurate with what our requirements were at the time that he had been in school and graduated. So I, again, I, right, there's no issues, so I would make a motion to accept the application and give Dr. William Barrett his license to practice podiatric medicine in the state of Arizona.
Seconded.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
So, all right. So moved. Next, we do have an application for registration to dispense drugs and devices by Dr. Matthew Klein. He was licensed last month. Looks like everything is complete. He's paid his fee of $200. So anybody have any questions or concerns? All right. So I will make a motion to accept the application for the initial registration to dispense drugs and devices for Dr. Matthew Klein.
Seconded.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Next is a compliance update on Dr. Brad Heyman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. This is Heather Broaddus. I have not had any updates from Dr. Heyman. If I do not receive an update with him within a week to 2 weeks, I will reach out to him. He's always been very timely in sending me an update. So at this time, I don't have anything.
And when we extend, you know, when we extended because he hadn't done any previous surgery, I'm trying to remember if we have a, we don't have an additional time frame on this. I'm trying to remember.
We do not. From what I can recall is that we have only, well, the board has only reviewed two or three cases, and he did request to be released from probation, but agreed to continue on that probation and consent agreement in order for the board to be able to review more cases. I've not received any.
So we'll just kind of keep us, you know, reach out to him again, and we didn't hear from you, so, okay. Do you have any concern on that? So, six, is the board's to review, discuss, and take possible action regarding the administrative order from Governor Ducey 2020-01, review and approve the implementation for registration of out-of-state licenses. So that's for Heather here.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. This order was issued by the Department of Health Services, and it requires boards to implement some sort of a procedure protocol for out-of-state licenses during this crisis. I don't anticipate that this board is going to have a lot of podiatrists that will be coming into the state, but in the event that we do have, you know, anybody from especially bordering states to help out during this crisis, I put a plan in place, and I just need the board to review the plan and make any changes, modifications, or to approve it. And once the board has taken action on it, then I can send it off to the governor's office and the Department of Health Services. So I'm happy to answer any questions. That's the only part of this order that this board has to take any action on.
Have you had anyone ask for this to be implemented, to ask for licensure from another state to come and practice?
Not at this time. I spoke with he's been licensed in several states, but I do not remember where he's actively licensed at. But he did ask about this crisis and if the board was, you know, making any sort of plan. And so I did, you know, speak with him briefly about this order and ask them to check in with me in a few weeks because the board has not made a determination on it yet. But that's the only inquiry I've received to date.
Okay, I'm going to be clear on this. Let's say he does this. Is he licensed in Arizona to practice after this crisis or no?
So this order is only during the crisis. So any licensee who were to come into Arizona that is not currently licensed in Arizona could practice under this order, but they also have to follow the plan that the board has put into place for out-of-state licensees. So they would not be required to be licensed in Arizona. After the crisis is resolved, then they would no longer be able to practice in Arizona. They would have to go back to their own licensure state. I hope.
Okay. Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
And you've created.
Yes.
Do we need to have a motion on this?
I'm sorry?
Do we need to have a motion to vote on this?
Yes, it does need to have board action, so a motion, and to direct me to submit it to the governor's office and to the Department of Health Services. That would need to be included in the motion.
And everybody's read that it's on page on the 2340. So everybody's read it. So then we just need a motion to direct Heather to move forward there. So anybody want to make a motion?
Make a motion to submit this to the Director of Health Services and to the governor for submission.
Seconded.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? We can all in favor with a voice vote. Aye.
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 Anyone aye. Opposed? Okay, so moved. Thank you. Then Heather's got her executive director's report, number 8.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. So an update on the rulemaking progress. I did file the docket opening and the notice of proposed rulemaking. I was told that the documents will be in the April 17, 2020 register, and that that record will close on May 18th. After that time, then I will file a notice of final rulemaking, and then it will be submitted to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. And that process usually takes about 60 days before the rules become effective. Due to this COVID-19 crisis, though, I don't know if the Governor's Regulatory Review Council is hearing anything that is not an emergency rulemaking package that I've not become aware of, but I will keep the board updated on that. With the board's Senate bill, SB 1094, that was stalled due to the COVID-19 crisis, the legislature only passed essential bills and then they adjourned until April 13th, and that is if it is safe for them to reconvene. So it's assumed that when this crisis is over and that they do come back and reconvene, that they will continue hearing bills that were stalled. But again, it's just uncertain right now with the crisis. And then going to the COVID-19 crisis, Governor Ducey has issued multiple executive orders. So I summarized and attached those orders for you. These are the ones that affect this board and healthcare boards specifically. And if you have any questions on those, I can definitely answer. And I've been trying to keep you updated on any of those that come out, you know, on a weekly basis. And that's, with this crisis, it's just basically one day at a time. It seems like guidelines and new orders are always coming out. So I'll just keep the board updated. And if nobody has any questions on that, then I'll go to the next item. It's regarding, I just wanted to provide a brief update on 1944B. It's for Devin Bland. He has undergone the evaluation that the board ordered, and as soon as I get that report, it'll be forwarded to the next available board meeting. And that's my summary, unless I can answer any questions. So the complaint log that I sent with the board materials, I have updated that. There is one additional complaint that I received yesterday that is now on the complaint log. For those board members that are present telephonically, they do not have that updated complaint log.
Mm-hmm. All right, so our next is summary of current events. A comment about the discussion you had with us?
No, I wasn't sure if you wanted to update the board regarding the national testing.
Yeah, okay. So I've been participating with the Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards and with the National Board of Podiatric Medical Examiners and a few of the other, you know, the student associations and things. So there's been a lot of discussion now regarding Prometric had closed all the testing centers, so that has affected everyone from MDs and DOs and obviously podiatrists. So there's just a lot of issues now. They're planning, they have talked about opening again by April the 16th, and they had nothing, they don't have any issue with, they hadn't planned to cancel any tests at that time because the bigger issues were May the 2nd. There is the retake of the Part 2 exam, and then June the 3rd is Part 2 exam, and then the Part 3 exam is scheduled in, I believe it's July the 6th. So as of this time, none of those have been canceled. They weren't planning on hiring any other testing groups or having off-site testing. So this is an issue because, like I think I mentioned before, in Pennsylvania, in order for students to enter their residency training, they have to have successfully completed Part 3, and because of that being in July, there could, you know, if that's canceled, it's going to it's creating a lot of, you know, issues for students and such. So we have another meeting this coming Thursday. So if you guys ever have, you know, call, you know, I'm more than happy to answer, you know, questions, if updates on things, you know, because everything's different from state to state with statutes and what people are doing with you know, training and licensing in school. As one of the other issues now too is the kids that are, you know, applying to podiatry school, they can't take their MCATs, so they're basing their applications on their GPAs and letters of recommendation, the other items in a application packet. So this is very far reaching. So then if there's not anything else there, if you guys have any questions, again, and call to the public. We have no public here to call today. Does anyone have any other items that they'd like to see discussed at future meetings? Okay. And our next board meeting is scheduled for May 13th, 2020, and it's in Boardroom A.
Yes, Madam Chair, board members, and I will keep the board updated as to whether or not we are going to be able to meet in person on May 13th. So again, I'm going to try to send out weekly updates to the board. If it is going to turn into a telephonic meeting, then I will send out a Google Meets meeting invitation, so that way we can participate virtually if any board member wanted to participate virtually, and then the call-in instructions will be in that invitation. But again, I'll keep the board updated on that. If it's in person, it is in Boardroom A.
Okay. All righty. So it seems like we've ready to adjourn. There's no other agenda items that anybody or concerns that anybody has to make. And so we've concluded our business. So I'll make a motion to adjourn the meeting at 10:56 a.m. on April the 8th, 2020. Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you for your patience, guys. It was.